What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a big Mideast speech from the president, Newt Gingrich, wades into controversy with the GOP and scandal as the IMF chief is arrested on attempted rape charges. President Obama spoke to the big change unfolding across the Arab world, looked to align America with the people.
The United States of America was founded on the belief that people should govern themselves. And now we cannot hesitate to stand squarely on the side of those who are reaching for their rights.
Newt Gingrich angered many in his own party with his sharp criticism of Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's big budget and Medicare plan.
I don't think right-wing social engineering is any more desirable than left-wing social engineering. I don't think imposing radical change from the right or the left is a very good way for a free society to operate.
And IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn was marched off to prison in handcuffs after an alleged sexual assault on a hotel maid. Here's the victim's attorney, Jeffrey Shapiro.
There was nothing that took place in that hotel room which in any way could be construed as consensual.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger of the New York Times, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Where are you on America and the Arab Spring, Israel and 1967 borders, Newt Gingrich as a GOP candidate, Schwarzenegger and Strauss-Kahn and their sex lives, Strauss-Kahn's alleged assault? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. David Sanger joins us from Washington, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. David Sanger, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you again.
Also with us from Washington, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for the Washington Post. Karen, it's great to have you with us as well.
Thanks again, Tom.
And hello, Jack. Great to have you here.
Hello, Tom, David, and Karen.
Let's listen to just a little bit more of President Obama on the changes in the Arab world. Speaking here yesterday in what the White House had billed as a major speech on the Middle East.
We have the chance to show that America values the dignity of the street vendor in Tunisia more than the raw power of the dictator. There must be no doubt that the United States of America welcomes change that advances self-determination and opportunity. Yes, there will be perils that accompany this moment of promise. But after decades of accepting the world as it is in the region, we have a chance to pursue the world as it should be.
The world as it should be, and the world changing a lot. David Sanger, what was the president's challenge in this speech yesterday? How do you see his angle on it?
I thought this was a really interesting speech, Tom, and I thought the reason that it was particularly striking was that for the past 4 or 5 months, we have seen this administration, by its own account, go into a country-by-country accounting of whether or not it was best to pursue American values or American interests in the region. And so you've seen very different reactions. You know, for a while, Mubarak got support in Egypt until it became clear he was a source of instability. Then the president pulled that support out. In Libya, there was a fairly rapid move to military action. In Syria, there was silence from Washington for a long time until the violence got too bad. Mm-hmm. And just a day before the president's speech, you saw sanctions. So it's been, and in Bahrain, you've seen very, very quiet American response until the speech because of the concern about the Fifth Fleet, which is, of course, based in Bahrain. So there's been this sense in the Arab world that the president was being overcalculating here. And I thought what was interesting about the speech was that he was saying that in the long run, it's American values that have to trump American interests. He didn't explain quite how that plays out in the short run.
Did you see a roadmap to not exactly to coin a phrase, but region-wide to balancing those here? I mean, as you say, we've got the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain. They're cracking down hard. And right on across the region, what we have understood as American strategic interests seem to be up against this new wave in a very conflicted way. Is the president threading that needle here, David?
Well, he's trying to thread that needle. What I didn't hear in the speech was how you do the balancing act. And essentially, the speech was to say that over the long run, the U.S. is not balancing. The U.S. is going to come down on the side of those seeking self-determination and American values. In fact, at two points in the speech, he literally put the uprisings on a historical continuum with the American Revolution and the Civil Rights Movement, which he said, of course, was responsible for why he was standing there giving the speech. So that was on one side. It was less threading, less balancing than I expected. On the other hand, there were some hard problems we didn't hear him address at all. For example, I never heard Saudi Arabia mentioned once in the speech.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the ultimate example of a country from which we have oil interests and which is the bulwark against Iran. He did not describe how he pursues this agenda of self-determination in a country that has been very critical, highly critical, of his decision to abandon Mubarak, and which has rolled into Bahrain to make sure that the government there is not in peril of falling to the protesters.
Of course, protesters still in the streets in Syria. The president warning the leader there, Assad, to get out of the way if he can't reform in that country and stop shooting his people. Reports today that people are still being shot in the streets of Syria. And then there was the issue of Israel. The president saying it needs to go back. Negotiations need to start from 1967 borders. That, of course, is a hot issue. I want to ask you about it politically, Karen. But here's the president on that front yesterday.
We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their full potential in a sovereign and contiguous state.
The president went on to say he wanted to see a demilitarized Palestinian state, that he did not support, would not support Palestinians' push for UN recognition of a Palestinian state this fall, which Israel is very concerned about. Karen Tumulty, this 1967 push got a furious reaction from Israelis. Prime Minister Netanyahu, we're told, even before the speech was given. How does it play out politically, Karen?
Well, it also got a furious reaction from just about everybody who is running for or thinking about running for the Republican presidential nomination in 2012, with Mitt Romney going so far as to say President Obama has thrown Israel under the bus. You know, you can argue, however, how much news there really was in this statement. I think it's been, even going back to the 90s, pretty much everyone who's involved in this, their working assumption has been that if there's going to be a deal, it is going to begin with these 1967 boundaries. What was significant was who was saying it and where he was saying it. So it's no longer a working theory. It is, because President Obama said it in a very high-profile speech, it becomes U.S. policy.
Israel saying right away, Jack, that President Bush in 2004 had promised Israel would not have to withdraw to those 67 borders. Prime Minister Netanyahu today calling those borders indefensible in military terms. But the president stepping up on that and other fronts anyway, Jack.
Yes. He seemed to be trying to indicate there, trying to signal something to the horizon of hope for the Palestinians. And I can imagine what he will say to Mr. Netanyahu in their meeting, which will be, I hope, candidly, that's what I'm trying to do. Unless these people believe something can happen, you're going to face, Israel is going to face, more and more scenes like the one earlier this week on the Nakba, on the anniversary of the Palestinian defeat of 1948 when there were these, you know, people rushing the borders. And there's even talk, what if that becomes a mass event, you know, with thousands of people? What does Israel do about that? And I think what he's trying to say is, you may not like this language, but we have to talk. If we're going to make any progress, we have to have some horizon of hope out there. And I think it was a brave thing that he did to use that language, and it sounds like it was his own doing. That Dennis Ross, reportedly, his advisor, didn't want it. Others didn't. And that the speech was held up while maybe they havered over that. I don't know. And I see by today's in the Israeli press today that a comment in David's paper in the Times this morning is getting a lot of attention in Israel, which was a remark of somebody allegedly close to Obama saying that Obama believes no progress can be made on this issue with Netanyahu as in Israel. So and that's getting a lot of attention in Israel.
David Sanger, how do you ultimately square this circle of empowerment of Arab people, democracies perhaps, and the demands that may flow from that, and Israeli demands and concerns? And here's the United States between the two.
Well, I thought that Karen made a very important point when she said that this has been the implicit assumption of all of the Mideast talks over the past, really, 12, 14 years. When you think back to Bill Clinton's comment, repeated comment, after the 2000 Camp David meetings, which failed, of course, that everyone knows what the solution is here within about 5% of the final agreement, and that is the 1967 agreement with swaps. And the president said with swaps. That got ignored a lot, I think, by some in Israel who were looking to see a presidential change here. The other thing that the president said, though, was that the Palestinians themselves had to have a demilitarized state,
mm-hmm.
and that they weren't, and that the resolution in the UN wouldn't do them very much good.
Big statements
so
in both directions.
I thought he did a pretty balanced approach.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a big one. The president speaks on the Middle East. Newt Gingrich runs into trouble. The head of the IMF, former head, charged with sexual assault. David Sanger of the New York Times is with us. Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post and our own Jack Beatty. Let's hear from our listeners on the president, maybe, and his speech. Northborough, Massachusetts, Bill is calling. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Two events this week, and you just covered one of them, namely the president's speech, particularly his comments as to what Israel has to do in the Middle East. That was one gutsy speech in that particular area. And I'm getting away a little bit from Israel. The Branch Mine disaster?
Yes, West Virginia.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what I would ask West Virginians and all the other people who are wringing their hands over this particular incident, when you elect people who tell you that government is the problem and not the solution, and when you have these same individuals cutting back on safety inspectors and putting in stooges heading the departments that are supposed to be monitoring these types of situations, what do they think the end result is going to be?
Bill, let us pick those up. Of course, they're the big mine disaster a year and more ago, and a big report out this week saying that that was not nature at work. That was the consequence, the result of Massey Energy and the federal government agency that was supposed to be keeping track of that, not minding the store. We'll turn to that. Carl in Nashville first. Carl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. You know, the speech yesterday, it reminded me of a story that happened in my household not that long ago. And my den share a wall with my two sons' bedroom.
Okay.
And I'm sitting in the den watching the game, and all of a sudden I hear them arguing. Now they're yelling, they're screaming, now they're throwing things, they're fighting. And finally, after about an hour or so, I just couldn't take it anymore, and I jumped up and I ran in there, and I looked them straight in the eye, and I looked at both of them, and I said, grow up, cut the daggone game off, get a book, write me a book report right now. And if you come back here with a small book, I'm going to make you read the biggest book in the house, which is the Bible.
So,
all the way through.
So what, you're hearing Israelis and Palestinians next door through the den wall?
Well, Thank you. Basically, what I took from it is President Obama looked at the Palestinians, looked at Israel, and told them, grow up. Now, my sons at the time, they thought they were being punished, but actually they were learning something because they did read a couple of books. I did make them write me book reports, and they end up learning something and learning a lesson that throwing and fighting, making a fit, don't solve anything. Grow up, guys.
Carl, I appreciate your call. David Sanger, it's not the first time American presidents have tried that kind of tough love in this scenario, and none have succeeded, though, in bringing this long, long conflict to a resolution.
Yeah, I think that we all wish that techniques that we use with our children might lend themselves to international affairs generally, but I find that they rarely work with my kids, and they almost never work in international affairs. In this particular case, the difficulty that the president has run into is that, of course, after so many years, and he made reference to this, with so little progress, that you've seen a lot of positions harden. So one of the other nuances of the president's speech was to say, we're not going to try this as an all or nothing, because if it is all or nothing, it's probably going to end up with nothing. So he wanted to start, he said, with the recognition of the broad 67 boundaries and with a definition of what this Palestinian state would look like. And he wanted to put off till after that is done the harder questions of Jerusalem and the right of return. And so by dividing this up, he's trying to get both sides to take some smaller steps first. Now, I'm not sure any of this is going to work in the current atmosphere. And the president found that he had to make an argument that, in fact, this isn't the worst time to be doing this. But I think most people who are familiar with the Middle East will tell you that this is certainly one of the hardest times, particularly with the reunification of Hamas and Fatah, or their apparent reunification, mm-hmm. because Hamas has still not renounced violence and still has in its charter that Israel has no right to exist. And it's very difficult, as one can imagine, to sit down and go try to argue boundaries and negotiate out with a country that says with a negotiating partner that says that Israel is not a legitimate country.
And yet, Karen Tumulty, to Carl's ear in Nashville, it sounded like a tough line, and I'm sure he's not the only one who heard it that way. The president sort of putting his position out there. Meanwhile, he's running for re-election. You say Republicans are pouncing on this right away. Mitt Romney saying he's throwing Israel under the bus. Politically, can Barack Obama push this this whole scene forward as he approaches 2012, or does he inevitably back off at some point, Karen?
Well, first of all, I want Carl to come over to my house and deal with my sons.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, it's still far from clear how much leverage the United States is going to have here going forward. And, you know, I think that is why it's really going to be interesting to watch both the president's meeting today with Prime Minister Netanyahu and also the speeches going forward that I think are, you know, both Netanyahu will be speaking to the Congress and to AIPAC. The president will be speaking to AIPAC. I think we're not going to have a real sense of where everybody lands on this for a while.
Even though the president's speaking, Jack, do you see clarity here? I mean, the president tried to lay it out pretty plain.
He certainly put in the balancing nuances. David has gone through some of them. But I think he's, you know, I see a continuity here in his analysis of the Arab Spring and what's happening in Israel-Palestine. The United States' approval rating in these countries is now something like 20%. The high hopes, the president talked about this, the expectations raised by the Cairo speech, as he said, they have gone unmet, those expectations. And I think he's trying to somehow connect these things and say to Palestinians that there's something, you know, that yes, we have the special relationship with Israel, that comes first, but he's going to go an extra mile to try to work something out for them. I mean, after all, if the issues in the Arab world are dignity and self-determination, my gosh, they apply in spades to the Palestinians, that crucial existential need. So I think he's really trying to signal there. And furthermore, that September rendezvous in the UN, where the Palestinians will ask to be recognized as a state with all the complications of that, I really think the administration wants somehow to head that off with a peace proposal. And the New York Times says, when will you show a map? Well, maybe they're holding the map until August or close to that period in September when, you know, they'll need desperately to take the attention away from what's happening in the UN.
But can you imagine?
I think it's worth noting that, mm-hmm. that this speech comes the very week that George Mitchell, who was the envoy in charge of all of this, mm-hmm. stuff, announced that he was quitting after a, you know, very, very frustrating stretch the job. I think he, mm-hmm. hadn't even been in the region since, I think, December.
And can you imagine if this fall, because the Palestinian push for recognition seems to have some support so far, including among U.S. European allies, if the United States is the veto vote on a U.N. recognition of a Palestinian state, put that up against the sort of calls for Arab dignity. Chaim in Somerville, Massachusetts. Chaim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The comment you reported from the Times of someone in the administration saying that Obama thinks that there won't be any progress with Netanyahu in power seems to me a very important one. The pressure to change either what Netanyahu is willing to do or who's in that position can't come from the United States or from including from President Obama. It can only come from the Israeli people. In the past, we've seen President Obama say some good things about what needs to happen in Israel-Palestine, but without follow-through. Now, he's gave this speech at a very important time, before today meeting with Netanyahu, and Sunday speaking to the APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee,
mm-hmm.
Which suggests that he's prepared to you know, push a little bit further than just that speech. But what I think is especially important now, given the suspicion in Israel about him and the fears in Israel about developments in the region now, I think what's really important is for him to go to Israel and speak directly to the Israeli people. That's where the change of perception needs to happen.
He's been to Cairo. He's spoken in Washington. Take it to Israel, you say. And one more on this. Thank you, Chaim. And one more on this subject. Mark in Omaha, Nebraska. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes. My question is, since when it is a bad idea to tell the truth, you know, about the peace process in between Israel and Palestine? Because what President Obama said yesterday wasn't what every president was saying under the radar. That's my first question. And my second question is, what is in the best interest for Israel? The peace or, you know, another 40 years without solving this problem?
Mark, those are both big questions. Permit me, I'm going to let those hang there. We're going to talk more about this issue on Monday, and we've got more news to get to today. Let me let those questions just sit right there, and we will take a big arc back to them early next week as this whole story rolls on. Other big story this week, kind of the sex scandal shockers and sexual assault charges in New York around the IMF, or now former IMF chief, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Here was yesterday the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., announcing the grand jury indictment of Strauss-Kahn.
The defendant was indicted on all of the charges presented to the grand jury, including criminal sexual act in the first degree, a Class B violent felony, and attempted rape in the first degree, a Class C violent felony.
Jack Beatty, talk about the great being brought low and in the most ignominious fashion there. These allegations in New York, the head of the IMF, a kind of transatlantic conversation going on here. This man was in line, many thought, to quite possibly be the next president of France. He spent a lot of this week in prison on Rikers Island. He'll be out at some point today on bail with an ankle bracelet and guards at the door of a Manhattan apartment. He's not supposed to be going anywhere. But what a scene, Jack.
Oh, yes. And the reaction in France is really puzzling. I mean, there's apparently, I don't know, I've even seen people saying a majority of French think that in some ways he was set up. That Begas belief how they could get there, and I don't know where that comes from. And as you read about the reporting today about the IMF in Washington, the, I don't know, nearly 1,000 people that work there, that it's a kind of island of extraterritoriality. That is to say, U.S. laws, well, they seem to apply, but they're not really what matters there. And that especially in questions of intimacy between employers and employees.
Economists gone wild, Jack.
Yeah, there's a kind of, well, yes, nothing here should rule out having an affair with your subordinate. Whereas in an American office and even in American law, that's just out.
But that's quite different, if these allegations have truth to them, than taking a maid in a hotel and really assaulting her as her account of what happened there. I mean, you take my point, Jack. It's one thing if there's kind of a randy environment at the IMF. It's another thing to attack a woman who's just doing her job in a hotel suite.
Oh, indeed. But it does indicate, you know, a level of pathology with the individual. There's a past history of this sort of thing, but also a kind of arrogance of power. I mean, acting like a pasha, and I'm just trying to say, you know, clearly this is all the fault of the individual, but behind him there does seem to be this sort of international laissez-faire on morals in some of these institutions.
Things blew up sexually on the West Coast as well. Arnold Schwarzenegger, already the news had been out that he was had separated from his wife Maria Shriver this week. The apparent cause, a child by a maid who had worked in that house for 20 years, that maid pregnant at the same time Maria Shriver was pregnant 10 years ago. And now Arnold really under a glare. This all came up before, back in his gubernatorial election campaign, the first one. And here he was back in 2003 on the same day that the LA Times reported on sexual harassment allegations by several different women against Arnold Schwarzenegger. The former bodybuilder and actor then apologized for past indiscretions.
Yes, it is true that I was on rowdy movie sets, and I have done things that were not right, which I thought then was playful, but now I recognize that I have offended people. And that those people that I have offended, I want to say to them, I'm deeply sorry about that, and I apologize, because this is not what I tried to do.
He's apologizing again now. Karen Tumulty, I guess Arnold Schwarzenegger was all done with politics in any case. But what is it? What's the impact, if any, on the political scene?
Well, once again, I find myself wondering, as I did in the John Edwards case, you know, what was this guy thinking when he decided to run for public office, knowing that he had this kind of secret essentially out there in plain sight? It's just stunning. And especially for, you know, so many of these guys, they make their family life and their family identities such an important part of their political identity. And of course, that had been so much of the fascination with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Maria Shriver was this, you know, movie star with, you know, who had come together with American political royalty. It really does boggle the mind. I don't know that it has any implications beyond, you know, just, you know, once again, reminding us that these people create these artificial realities when they run for office.
How brutal for Maria Shriver, out of a famous political clan herself with no small history in these quarters, but now with it just rolling into her family so fiercely, Karen.
It was interesting, too. I think it was the New York Times pointed out, she's been apparently estranged from the former governor for some months, but that her own father's funeral, Sergeant Shriver's funeral, one of the things she did was congratulate her brothers on having learned from her father how to treat women.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, LinkedIn went public and share values more than doubled in the first day of trading. Here's CNBC's Julia Boorstin on the offering.
LinkedIn is not only the first major social media company to IPO, it's also one of the most highly anticipated and largest internet IPO in years. Its high pricing, a sign of Wall Street's interest in social networking and the value of waiting to go public.
And the whole lot of money. Late Night's Jimmy Fallon reacted to news of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Big Secret.
The weird thing is he just slipped it in a speech and hoped no one was listening. He was like, we have to work on the budget problems in education, and I fathered the child with the staffer and Medicare, Social Security. So, like, it's so crazy, everything.
Oh, my gosh. And recovering Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords picked a special wake-up call in space for her husband, Space Shuttle Commander Mark Kelly, and his crew. U2's beautiful day. It's the closing days of this tradition. The last shuttle launches in July. We're looking at a week in the news. The president speaks on the Middle East. Newt Gingrich runs into trouble. The head of the IMF charged with sexual assault, David Sanger. The New York Times is with us. Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post and Jack Beatty. A little more on Strauss-Kahn and Schwarzenegger. Stefan in Charleston, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, Stefan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment, I don't condone anything that Arnold Schwarzenegger did, but Maria Shriver, come on, this has been through her family. She's been exposed to this kind of thing before. What there has to have been a benefit for her to have stuck it out that long. Could it have been that appalling that she not leave until the end?
Well, she does have, you know, children with this man and an interest in their being brought up in a household, presumably with a mother and father. I mean, it's you can't blame her for wanting to hang in, can you?
Separating a family either, but, you know, I don't know. It's politics game. This thing's going to go away for sure. So there was a reason to stick it out until the end of his political career.
Yeah, well, that is always there in politics. That's, I mean, there's always that element. Of course, she defended him so stoutly at the beginning of his race for the California governorship. We're right on at the crescendo of it when everything was on the line. She was the one who smoothed the waters, might have made that victory possible in the first place. Let me go to Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom, I think Arnold Schwarzenegger's marriage with his wife should not be a matter for investigative reporters from the L.A. Times. If they had investigated the sexual behavior of a woman, they would be called victimizing her. Yet when they go after someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger, it becomes legitimate investigative reporting. I think we're in an era of sexual McCarthyism. I mean, I saw a letter to the editor of the New York Times that if a man has sex with a subordinate, even if it's consensual, that's a form of rape.
Yeah, but come on, Steve, if you look back at the record here, there's so much reporting about Arnold Schwarzenegger with his sort of hand up every skirt in sight, women in tears. Look at Strauss-Kahn on that front. This was not the first time that he's been associated with attacks on women, and these people are in big leadership positions. I mean, doesn't that matter at all?
I think we're going too far, Tom. I think there may have been a time when these things, people looked the other way, but now it seems that there's kind of a hypersensibility. I mean, the other day I heard you a show where it sounded like at Harvard University there was some kind of misogynistic reign of terror going on. And, you know, I've been with that university in a support role position for 22 years, and believe me, there's no misogynistic reign of terror going on.
I don't know about misogynistic reigns of terror, but David Sanger, fair game this week? I mean, here you've got criminal charges against the IMF head, and, okay, Arnold's not governor anymore, but this has swirled around him for a long time, and is a family broken with a guy who's just out of office. What's fair, what's not, David?
Well, let's try to separate these out. First of all, on Mr. Strauss-Kahn, who many of us here in Washington dealt with often, I did on IMF issues.
Mm-hmm.
This was about criminal charges. So this, you know, to some degree, this is not about whether or not there's a permissive atmosphere within the IMF or a more European sensibility or whatever. This was about a criminal act. Just and if you if it had been any other significant felony, I think there probably would have been, even without the lurid nature of this, similar headlines. So I think that as a matter of press attention, Strauss-Kahn was completely fair game. Now, in the Schwarzenegger case, you certainly have a public figure. So within the realm of whether or not this is legally permissible, absolutely. I think you can make the case that since his political career, at least for now, has ended, mm-hmm. it doesn't quite have the saliency that it would if he was still in office or was running for office on a sort of family values platform, which has been, you know, why Newt Gingrich's different marriages have gotten so much attention, renewed attention in recent times. But, you know, Schwarzenegger was certainly not doing anything to take himself out of the public light. He was restarting his movie career with planned Terminator movies.
Yeah,
he had
a
book
way.
On the mm-hmm. way. And, you know, if you are Arnold Schwarzenegger and you're married to Maria Shriver, you're never going to be out of the public figure category in either a legal or journalistic sense.
I guess if you ride celebrity into office, you can't divorce yourself
you
from all that on the way
off
out.
You can't turn it off the day you come out. That's right.
Anthony in Toronto, Canada. Anthony, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think I want to take my... I have a lot of respect for the American justice systems. And I think if it was, I'm talking regarding the DSK alleged rape.
Strauss-Kahn, yes.
I think it was in France or even in Canada, I live in Canada, or UK, I'm sure you would have gone scot-free. Well, I think I'm very happy with the way these things is working in America, and I'm very happy about that.
It was a close call, but I know exactly what you mean, Jack. I mean, that was some image. Those detectives headed right onto the plane where he's sitting in first class ready to jet off to France, where there's no extradition treaty. I mean, these are all allegations at this point, but you do have to have some pride in the American justice system, not cowed by power. In a time when you've got guys like Berlusconi, let's say, running a whole country in what looks such a flagrant way.
Yes, and one wonders with what satisfaction those the transit or port authority police went on the plane to pull the first class passenger, this pasha, off. That must have given. It made me think of Gene Hackman in the French Connection. You know, pursuing the French aristocrat, watching him eat in this fancy restaurant. Yeah, I mean, there's something to be proud of there. But you know, both of these cases, David is right, obviously they're intrinsically different, but they do show this element of power. Men abusing their power sexually. And I think this, to speak to Steve's point, this isn't sexual McCarthyism. This is just what equality means. I mean, that's the revolution. That's the change. Men and women have to be treated equally. You can't abuse your power. A man can't abuse his power vis-a-vis a woman in this country any longer and get away with it. And men do. But if the standard has just changed. And that's something to be proud of.
I want to turn the page here, if I may, because we've got big news in the Republican camp this week. Newt Gingrich, who had just announced for the presidency, coming out with very critical remarks about Republican Paul Ryan's big budget proposal. Here he was on David Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press. This was on Sunday. Boy, what a firestorm came after. Talking about Ryan's proposal, it calls for significant changes to Medicare and Medicaid, and the candidate for the GOP nomination just tore straight into it with kind of classic Gingrich language. Here's Newt Gingrich.
I don't think right-wing social engineering is any more desirable than left-wing social engineering. I don't think imposing radical change from the right or the left is a very good way for a free society to operate. I think we need a national conversation to get to a better Medicare system with more choices for seniors.
Right-wing social engineering, he called it, radical on the right. He turned around to say, if anybody uses that in a commercial against me, it's just not right, it's not fair. But there it was, and Republicans up in arms in a hurry. Here was on Fox News special report with Brett Baer. On the next day, Monday, conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer slamming Gingrich for his comments on the Ryan budget plan.
This is a big deal. He's done. He didn't have a big chance from the beginning, but now it's over. Apart from being contradictory and incoherent, calling the Republican plan, which all but the four Republican members of the House have now endorsed and will be running on, calling it radical and right-wing social engineering, is deadly.
Deadly, and he ran into it right away on the campaign trail at a campaign stop in Dubuque, Iowa, on Tuesday, one of, what, a dozen or 15 he was to make there. He was confronted by a local Republican, Russell Furman, right there in the kind of hotel hallway, angry over Gingrich's criticism of Paul Ryan's plan.
Mr. Gingrich, what you just did to Paul Ryan is unforgivable.
I didn't do anything to Paul Ryan.
Yes, you did. You undercut him and his allies in the House.
No, I said...
You're an embarrassment to our party.
I'm sorry you feel that way.
Why don't you get out before you make a bigger fool of yourself?
Boy, it doesn't get worse than that for a candidate on the trail, I think. Karen, is he finished?
Well, you know, it is really, it would be at this point a real remarkable turnaround for him to be able to salvage this campaign. What we saw this week, I think, is what everyone who's known Newt Gingrich had expected to happen when he ran for president. I just think people were shocked that it came so quickly. Newt Gingrich has always been someone who has used, big language when small language would do. All of the Republican candidates have tried to sort of both, praise Paul Ryan, who is a real hero to the conservative grassroots, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, without actually endorsing this plan, which, could be real problems in a specifically what it does to Medicare could be real problems in an election. But Newt Gingrich kind of sometimes his thought processes even can make some sense, but the way it comes out of his mouth doesn't. So he both dissed a rising star in the party, an idea man, who's regarded much as Newt himself was regarded by an earlier generation. And he has also provided the Democrats the absolute perfect soundbite to use against every single Republican who voted for the budget that included this Ryan plan on Medicare.
David Sanger, is he representing something there when he calls this plan right-wing social engineering, radical change? Is that backroom chatter being channeled through, maybe the grandiosity of Newt Gingrich? Are there others who feel that way or worried about these plans? Or was this just him out on his own moonbeam?
I suspect that he was out, if not on his own moonbeam, then at least out on his own tangent, because there are a lot of criticisms of the Ryan plan. But the most central of those criticisms don't really have a whole lot to do with social engineering. In fact, they have to do with the fact that the Ryan plan is remarkably unspecific about which of the entitlement programs one begins to go off and cut. And, as you've heard many times on this show and others, if you're not dealing with Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, you're not talking seriously about how one's going to get to a long-term balance in this budget. And so are there degrees of social engineering as you'd go deal with that? Yeah, but the central question is, to what degree are individual Republican candidates and then Democrats also willing to sign up to very specific accountings of how much one can cut into the entitlement programs and defense? And so I thought that it was an interesting but somewhat off-point critique that got him in so much trouble. And I'm with Karen. I mean, I guess he can recover from this, but it's pretty hard to imagine why. And certainly if you go into his recent books and so forth, it's hardly the most outrageous thing that he's said or written in recent times.
Of course, social engineering, Jack. I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe it is the Ryan plan. We had David Stockman on this week talking about Ronald Reagan's former budget director, saying that Paul Ryan's plan attacks the poor and coddles the rich. That's a kind of engineering, if that's true, if there's any truth in that, Jack.
Yes, and that seems to be what the public thinks. According to ABC Washington Post poll, 84% of Americans oppose the Ryan plan, notably in its essentially abolition of Medicare, if it's accurately described. And the 84%, that's what Newt Gingrich was tacking to. That's why Republican presidential candidates are being ambiguous about it. That's why next week Mitch McConnell is not whipping Senate Republicans to vote for it. The fear, and that's why in the New York 26th district, which has been Republican for 50 years, a Democrat may be elected, one of the reasons. The fear is growing in the GOP that the Ryan plan, signed on by all but four House Republicans, may be a suicide note to the electorate. Yep. And he is a hero to the right. They think he is brave and bold, and that this is exactly the kind of you know, what we elect people to do. But boy, 84%, that's a tough sell.
Karen, I want to get you on one other prominent Republican who will not be running for the presidency in 2012, former Arkansas governor and previously presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. Here he is announcing on his Fox News talk show Saturday that he's not going to be in the race.
All the factors say go, but my heart says no. And that's the decision that I have made.
4 years ago, he was in. He's more, it looks like a, you know, kind of an open field on the Republican side this time. Why not for Mike, Karen?
Well, you know, I did a long interview with him in February, and it was pretty clear to me then that he wasn't running for a number of reasons. One, he hated the process last time. He hated the unending series of debates that just said, you know, asked the same thing over and over. Mm-hmm. He hated running coast to coast with a tin cup begging people to give him money. And speaking of money, he's making a lot of it these days, speaking and doing his television show on Fox. He is living a pretty darn good life.
So who's got the fire in the belly then? If Haley Barbour doesn't, if Mike Huckabee doesn't, what do you see coming, Karen?
Well, I don't know. I guess we're going to have to decide, you know, whether Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney count as fire in the belly.
Well, they're in the race. I guess news that Tim Pawlenty will formally announce in just a couple of days here. So at least they're in, as we see others. Huckabee out now, and Gingrich looking a little wobbly. Wow. We didn't even get to the Gang of Six and the debt ceiling, but we will hear much more about that, no doubt, in weeks ahead. Karen Tumbley with The Washington Post, national political correspondent there. Thank you very much for being with us today, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
And David Sanger, author of The Inheritance, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack, thanks for being here. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.